Please be seated. Call the next case. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Nancy Schlichting of Linhart Pettit, and I represent Sarah Yancey May, who is a minority shareholder in this family-owned lumber mill business started by her deceased father over 65 years ago. I intend to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case began with Sarah seeking emergency injunctive relief to stop the sale of the lumber mill business by her two brothers, Dan and Dick, who through the amendment of the company's bylaws with a mere majority vote, attempted to circumvent the more than two-thirds voting requirement set forth in Section 13.1-724, which requires that the disposition of a company's assets, which are outside the usual and regular course of business, be approved by a vote of more than two-thirds of the vote of the shareholders. The interpretation of the statute is central to this appeal, and the first sentence of the statute that we're talking about, 13.1724, reads, a sale, lease, exchange, or other disposition of the corporation's assets other than a disposition described in 13.1723, which is a disposition in the regular course of business, requires approval of the corporation's shareholders if the disposition would leave the corporation without a significant continuing business activity. That is a mandate that has been in place since 1985, when the Virginia adopted the most of the provisions of the Model Act set forth by the ABA. And the central issue is whether or not the shareholders, the mere majority of the shareholders, could amend the bylaws of the corporation in order to circumvent that voting requirement. The second sentence of that statute reads, unless the articles of incorporation or a shareholder-approved bylaw otherwise provide, if a corporation retains a business activity that represented at least 20% of a total assets at the end of the most recently completed fiscal year and 20% of either income or revenue, then that would be deemed to have retained a significant continuing business activity. In other words, the statute includes a safe harbor that, if met, would obviate the need for the corporation to obtain that more than two-thirds shareholder voting requirement.
In other words, a higher safe harbor threshold as opposed to a lower one.
Correct. And the appellee and the company has relied on the language at the beginning of that sentence, second sentence, unless the articles of incorporation or shareholder-approved bylaw otherwise provide. And they've relied on that particular phrase in order to make changes to the company's bylaws with a mere majority vote of the shareholders. And it's our position that the positioning of that particular phrase, which appears to give a corporation the ability to change or alter that particular safe harbor, its position at the beginning of the safe harbor and not in front of the first sentence with the mandate requiring a two-thirds majority, a more than two-thirds vote, that position lessens the impact and does not give the company the ability to amend the bylaws with a mere majority vote. If, in fact, as the company would have this court believe, that it is, in fact, free to write whatever safe harbor that it wants to with that language, which provides some flexibility to corporation, if, in fact, the court reads the statute that way, that would make the first sentence of the statute meaningless. meaning that a mere majority of the shareholders would be able to write a safe harbor to, which is in fact what was done in this case. They wrote a safe harbor that they were sure that the transaction could meet, and therefore it obviated the need for the more than two-thirds majority vote.
How do you factor subsection E into your interpretation?
Well, subsection E allows the board of directors of a company to require a greater vote, but not a lesser one. But subsection E also allows a company's articles of incorporation to provide for a greater or lesser vote as long as it is not less than a majority. In this case, the articles of incorporation for this corporation were silent. Therefore, you default to the statutory section, which is at 13.1707, which when you, to amend the articles of incorporation, it requires, again, that heightened standard of a more than two-thirds majority vote of the shareholders.
So basically, at a supermajority level, any corporation can drop all the thresholds if they want to, but they still have to do it at a supermajority level.
Correct. That's correct. The more than two-thirds vote, which is very specific to the Virginia statute and actually exceeds what the Model Act provides. The Model Act provides for majority vote.
So under the Model Act, you could adopt a bylaw that would take care of this? And you wouldn't need a supermajority?
That's correct.
So if they're essentially have as their baseline the Model Act and they make some Virginia-specific changes, is it possible to say, will they retain that for the bylaw path? Via simple majority, because that's all it takes to change a bylaw.
If the Virginia statute read like the Model Act, yes, they would have been able to do what they did.
As far as sort of, you know, a common sense approach, I mean, this is fairly drastic for a corporation to basically put itself out of business, and it makes sense that you don't want oppression of minority shareholders, and so you have these higher thresholds built in, but just grammatically, you know, the way it's just written is what I struggle with. So if I'm just asked, well, as a matter of sort of common sense and the overarching objective of the legislature, that seems to make the most sense. But the way it reads sort of lends itself to a different interpretation. So I looked at the Goolsbee on corporations, and it didn't sort of clearly say one way or the other. That's not how you read it. So that's what I'm left with.
Well, the phrase is somewhat vague. It says unless otherwise provided otherwise. It does not say unless an alternative definition is adopted or unless the articles or bylaws do not require the affirmative vote of more than two-thirds of the shares. It doesn't have that type of specificity. But if you read the statute with the placement of that qualifying language, It allows, I believe the most reasonable interpretation of that language would be that you would allow a corporation to opt out of using this particular safe harbor. If you read this to say that they can write their own safe harbor, then they can nullify the protection provided by the first sentence of the statute, which is one of the few places in the corporate statute, admittedly, where it has this heightened standard. Virginia does like the flexible approach of a corporation being able to self-determine, but at the same time, there are certain protections for certain issues, for instance, a disposition of the bulk of the assets of a corporation. And therefore, it has provided this particular safe harbor in order to provide some certainty and some flexibility to the corporations that are, in fact, contemplating a transaction of that magnitude.
But why doesn't the unless provision, unless the articles or bylaws say otherwise, really simply refer back to the conclusive presumption, the 20% conclusive presumption, and limit it to that? And wouldn't that give a contextual meaning to it as well as place it in the broader framework of the supermajority rule?
I believe, Your Honor, I believe I understand your question, and I would agree that it does provide some context when it's confined to dealing with that particular portion of the statute.
Because the 20% rule, while it's a conclusive presumption, it's arbitrary, of course, and a small, closely held company could sit down and say, that's just not the way our business is organized. We need to move it to 30 or whatever.
But, Your Honor, if the corporation does not meet that safe harbor, they have the ability to prove through other means that they do meet the standard of having a significant continuing business activity.
Right.
This just provides the safe harbor in the event that they can meet that. But to allow a corporation with a mere majority to amend its bylaws to change the threshold to where it can be met.
It hardly makes sense to say you have a two-thirds vote unless 51% of you agree that you don't need a two-thirds vote, because that's the argument on the other side.
And if you read the statute in conjunction with subsection E, that has a specific mechanism by which the voting requirement can be changed, and it talks about the articles being amended.
So a supermajority can downgrade a supermajority, but a majority can't downgrade a supermajority.
Exactly, Your Honor. And if it is read that a mere majority can change the supermajority threshold or get rid of it with respect to the transaction, then it is gutting the statute. And that could not possibly be what the legislature intended. With respect to the issue of, Your Honors, there's two questions. Did the shareholders do this with the proper vote? Did they amend their bylaws to change the safe harbor with a proper vote? And it's our position that they did not. But even if this court finds that they did amend their bylaws properly, can they in fact pass a valid amendment which creates its own safe harbor under this statute? And it's our position that they cannot do either. That the vote was improper, as well as the creation of a new safe harbor, could not do that. With respect to the issue of latches, I just want to touch on it briefly. It's our position that that the issue of latches is rendered moot the erroneous interpretation of the trial court. If the court had properly interpreted the statute, the actions of Sarah subsequent to a corporate action, which is null and void, would not be relevant. But if this court finds that it is relevant, there was evidence presented and a chronology of events that demonstrates that there was a very short amount of time between when the amendments were made to the safe harbor, which was in March of 2016, that there was a letter of intent not until May of 2017, another amendment to the letter of intent in June of 2017, and that the lawsuit was filed in August of 2017 when it became clear that the company intended to move forward despite Sarah's continued assertion that the actions it had taken were null and void. I'm going to reserve the remaining time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Hal Johnson. I'm with Williams Mullen, and we represent the appellee, R.A. Yancey Lumber Corporation. The appellant has tried to make this argument solely an issue of statutory interpretation, and I will gladly address those issues here momentarily. But I want to begin by emphasizing to the court that there are two independent factual findings to which this court must defer, and the trial court's rulings are entitled to deference of a jury verdict. And those factual findings are both dispositive and fatal to the plaintiff's arguments. The first goes to the issue of the approval of the bylaw amendment. In fact, it received a 70% shareholder vote. The ultimate bylaw amendment that is before the court today, and which was acted upon by the court in deciding to enter into a sale of the mill business, was approved by 5 of the 6 shareholders holding 70% of the votable shares. That was a stipulated fact. It is undisputed, and it drives a stake through the heart of the plaintiff's claims with regards to whether you need a two-thirds majority. Regardless of whether you do or you don't, we had a two-thirds majority that approved the ultimate bylaw amendment, Article 12 of the bylaws that redefine the safe harbor. The second factual issue is the one that my counterpart raised with regards to latches. I cannot think of a better example in this case for why we have the doctrine of latches in the common law. The complaint complaint alleges that Ms. May, the plaintiff, or the appellant, objected to the initial plans and talk of selling the mill business as far back as 2014. When the initial bylaw amendments occurred in 2015, she objected. When the ultimate bylaw was amended in the winter of 2016, she again objected. Her counsel sent a letter on January 29, 2016, challenging the validity of the ultimate bylaw amendment on the same grounds that are set forth in this lawsuit and appeal. And yet, Ms. May waited until August of 2017, 3 weeks before the sale was set to close, to file her lawsuit. We're all familiar with the maxim that equity aids the vigilant. Well, not only was Ms. May not vigilant here, it was deliberate. It was a strategic filing because she knew that by waiting until the 11th hour to drop a lawsuit in the lap of the corporation, she'd scare away the buyer and scuttle the deal.
Let me ask you something. Why do you think lackeys applies here when, if it were in a breach of contract context, it would be a 5-year statute of limitations?
Well, she's seeking equitable relief.
I know that.
And so the only claim in the lawsuit is for permanent injunctive relief. And I don't know that there would be a breach of contract claim here.
I'm not saying there is. I'm just saying that in a breach of contract context, there's a 5-year statute of limitations. So why do you think, in this instance, when we are applying latches to this equitable relief that's being sought, which I think, you know, I would think you'd look at statute of limitations to see how latches ought to work?
Yes, sir, and I think at the outset, latches is separate. It's distinct from the statute of limitations. It is far more fact-dependent and circumstantial, and this Court's case law recognizes that, as we wrote in our brief. And so you can't just look at a statute of limitations and match that up with a period for latches. You have to look at what's going on in the case, the prejudice suffered, and the delay.
No, but equity follows the law, and as Justice Goodwin is pointing out, we would presume the law statute of limitations is the baseline, and equity can deviate upward or downward from that. So we start with the presumption.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that when you're talking about corporate governance and corporate actions, allowing a minority shareholder to wait 5 years to bring an action, or 2 years, whatever the case may be, while in the meantime the corporation continues on down a path to great prejudice. It spent a lot of money trying to organize this deal and going through due diligence and negotiations. And that would allow shareholders to sit and lie in wait, which is what happened in this case.
No, it wouldn't, because the majority shareholders can bring a declaratory judgment action. If they're really worried about this person gumming up the works, bring a deck action.
Well, Your Honor, and that was addressed in the trial court. That question was asked. I don't think that Virginia law wants to put the onus on the corporation to ask a court to rubber stamp every action that it takes. This corporation was advised by counsel, and they went through every process of corporate formalities to reach this result, and they had a 70% shareholder vote in favor of the amendment.
May I interrupt you there? Because twice you've mentioned that, but Bill May was one of the votes, am I right?
Yes, sir.
And the second amendment to the bylaws you're referring to was limited to clarifying the fair market value with respect to the, quote, gross land and improvement values for taxation purposes, irrespective of the land use deferral. I mean, it had a very narrow application, and as I read the record, Mr. May testified that he did not approve the redefinition of significant continuing business activity in the First Amendment, and that he still opposed the sale of the corporation. So where do you get to 70% from that testimony?
Well, it's a stipulated fact, Your Honor. If you look at...
But the what I'm trying to say is the thing that was voted upon, and that this vote was one of the votes, was not simply, let's do away with the two-thirds. It was managing a very narrow financial issue.
I understand that, Your Honor, and it's a valid point, but I don't know how a corporation can distinguish and slice it so thin as to say that if you vote for this amendment, you're not bound by the bylaw that is being amended. I mean, it really is that simple. If Mr. May had the opportunity to say, no, I still object to Article 12, I don't think it should have been amended in the first place, and he was not at the original shareholder meeting. In fact, his vote was made by proxy by their son. But if you vote for an amendment, you vote for it full stop. I don't think that you are then allowed... Again, 2 years later...
You can't say, I disagree with where y'all are going, but I agree, if we go in this direction, this is how we should work the numbers. But I disagree with the ultimate change that was made over my objection at the prior hearing, prior meeting.
He can say that, but if he votes for the amendment, I don't know how could a corporation govern itself if shareholders are allowed to say, I agree with that part of the amendment, and so I'll vote for it, but not this part. It would be unworkable.
Well, it wouldn't be unworkable if you had an attorney who drafted the amendment to include what was in the first change. You know, if you really want this 70% vote concerning changing the number of I forgot what the First Amendment changed, why wouldn't you put it in the Second Amendment and get 70% for that? Otherwise, why wouldn't the amendment stand on their own 2 feet? And from what I can tell, the amendment that was passed by 70% vote states as follows. For purposes hereunder, the most recent gross land and improvement values determined by local tax authority for local taxation of real property owned by the corporation, irrespective of any land use deferral, shall be considered such real estate's fair market value absence existence of fair market value determination by qualified real estate appraiser. Okay, that was passed. That was passed by 70% vote. So why would it pass anything else other than the language that was specifically in the amendment?
Your Honor, the ultimate bylaw amendment amended Article 12 of the bylaws, which specifically references Section 724 of the Act and the significant continuing business activity.
And you got a less than two-thirds vote for that, correct?
The original bylaw amendment in December of 2015 was carried by a simple majority.
Correct.
The ultimate bylaw amendment, which was only to Article 12, it amended Article 12.
In the way that I just stated?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. And it was passed by 70% vote.
Right. So the amendment passed, but that doesn't mean the underlying bylaw passed by more than a mere majority.
Well, but if you amend a bylaw, that becomes the new bylaw.
You know, I'm struggling as Justice Goodwin's struggling. I mean, if you go into a corporate board meeting and someone wants to do, you know, change you from a tax cash basis taxpayer to an accrual basis taxpayer, and you go, I don't agree with that, and it gets voted anyway, and you lose. And now the next subject on the table is, well, okay, how do we go about doing what you just disagreed with, Mr. Kelsey? All right, well, if we're going in that direction, here's how I think we should do it. But that's not endorsing all of the prior acts of the corporation that were ultra vires. Unless, of course, as Justice Goodwin says, you flat out say that, which is, look, we're not going forward until all of you guys sign off on the cash basis change or the accrual basis, whatever. You see the point?
I think I see the point, Justice Kelsey, but I do think it becomes unworkable because then you end up with a question as to every bylaw amendment. Well, if somebody objected to it, then do we have, you know, a full majority that would pass? In fact, equate it to a statute. Once a statute is amended, that becomes effective, regardless of how many legislators may have voted against its passage or the reasons for which they did so. And you may have a legislator who says, you know what, I don't agree with this statute, but if we're going to do it, let's do it this way.
But you can't amend a statute that didn't pass the first time by a majority. You can't amend a statute that's not a statute, and you can't amend a bylaw that by statute is not, in fact, a proper bylaw. You can't ratify it after the fact, I guess is the point.
And Justice Kelsey, I apologize but if we're arguing around and around on this, and I don't mean to, but no. I don't see how you can have a bylaw amendment that is proposed through the ordinary course and properly noticed, is approved by 70% of the shareholders, how that could not be effective.
Well, it is effective.
If Mr. May did not agree with the original bylaw amendment, he should not have voted for the second one. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I don't think he gets to sit here after the fact and try to rewrite history. And if I may return to your point, Justice Goodwin, with regards to the latches argument, if you look at 13.1-741.1, that provides limitations for other remedies for fundamental transactions within a corporation. And it specifically references 724 and exempts 724 from the operation and limitations period here. But the reason I cite to that statute is because it notes that a proceeding of a shareholder who is aggrieved by a vote that is less than unanimous must proceed to challenge the corporate action within 10 days after notice of the adoption or taking of the corporate action is effective. And the reason I raise that is because in the context of latches, if you allow a shareholder to sit and sit and sit and then take action after the corporation has proceeded down the chosen path of the majority, you upset the apple cart in a tremendous way. The corporation has to be able to rely on its own internal decision-making process and move forward accordingly. And if a shareholder wants to challenge that process, they need to do so promptly and vigorously.
Counsel, just in case you didn't have 70%, would you address why, in your opinion, you didn't need it?
Yes, ma'am. The statute does not require it. The safe harbor allows for the alteration, and the safe harbor alteration mechanism is not in the Model Act. That was added by the Virginia General Assembly in keeping with our historic approach to giving corporations flexibility to deviate from default rules. And the safe harbor begins with the phrase, unless the articles of incorporation or a shareholder-approved bylaw otherwise provide. That allows the corporation to alter the safe harbor however it deems fit to fit its
Why isn't the appellant's argument that that would gut the statute correct? If you can lower it by a simple majority when you require two-thirds to approve the action, why isn't her argument that it would gut the statute?
Several reasons. First of all, approving a bylaw amendment is a separate function from voting on the disposition of assets. Those are two separate things. And the General Assembly clearly knew in paragraph E, knew how to require a two-thirds vote for the disposition of assets. But Section A does not require, and how easy would it have been for the General Assembly to say, unless the articles of incorporation or a bylaw approved by at least two-thirds of the shareholders otherwise provide. But they did not. Nor did the General Assembly in Section E, where you have the two-thirds requirement, say that you need the two-thirds for a disposition of the assets or to amend a bylaw in accordance with Section A. The General Assembly did not use those words, and the appellant is asking this court to rewrite the legislation. And I would also point out, it's not as though the General Assembly didn't limit the ability to tailor this safe harbor at all, because it says, unless the articles of incorporation or a shareholder-approved bylaw. Under Virginia law, bylaws may be amended by the directors in addition to the shareholders. And the General Assembly looked at this and said, well, we don't want the directors to be allowed on their own, without a majority of the shareholders approving, to define what the business's goals are and what will be a significant continuing business activity. So they put a limitation in there. It has to be in a bylaw that is amended by the shareholders. That's a limitation, but the General Assembly did not go so far as to require that bylaw amendment to be achieved through the approval of more than...
You haven't addressed subsection E yet. You want to do that before you run out of time?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Subsection E, you have not addressed that yet, how that factors into your argument that 51% can overrule two-thirds.
Well, frankly, I think subsection E is helpful because it expresses a baseline policy in Virginia for majority rule. It allows corporations to ratchet down the two-thirds requirement to a simple majority. And that is in keeping with the case law from this
But
court.
Two-thirds have to vote for a greater vote, to require a greater vote.
Well, that assumes that you already have articles of incorporation. Our company is decades old, and so we did. And those articles don't address this issue. But a corporation now could be founded, and in fact, Mr. Goolsbee recommends that corporations do precisely that and reduce the threshold down to a majority.
In the articles of incorporation, but not in the bylaws.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, that makes sense.
Yes, sir. And I see that I'm out of time, unless there are other questions.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you very much.
On that last point regarding the Articles of Incorporation, because the articles are indeed very old and do not address the issue of their own amendment, it defaults to the Statute 707 that I spoke of previously that requires a more than two-thirds vote in order to amend the Articles of Incorporation. And therefore, subsection E is significant in that it would require that the Articles of Incorporation be amended in order to accomplish what the these shareholders tried to accomplish. With respect to the, just to clarify, with respect to Bill May's testimony, I believe that your honors have recognized, although there was a stipulation that he voted in favor of that second amendment, Bill May's testimony was that he understood the voting just to be in a tweak on the amendment as a whole that he had previously objected to through his proxy. And in fact, the stipulation was not as to the impact of this vote, and as Justice Goodwin pointed out, the actual amendment that was voted on was redlined, and it's part of the record that it was a very discreet issue that was being voted on, and specifically how you calculated the fair market value of the property, whether it was going to be by land use value or by fair market value. With respect to the additional points on the latches, I will point out that the last that while there had been attempts to try to sell the company, the timber business previously, nothing was really serious, and the last LOI was actually signed in June of 2017, and the lawsuit was filed by Ms. May less than 2 months later on August 11th. And there was testimony, as the court asked, regarding why there was no deck action filed, and corporate counsel confirmed that they had considered it but declined to do it. Your Honors, we believe that the 13.1724A has the clear mandate in the first sentence, and that by the virtue of the legislator including a safe harbor, that it did not intend to penalize minority shareholders. And I would pose the question to the court that if, in fact, the General Assembly had not provided that guidance, which it had hoped to help corporations by adding that safe harbor, did that not create this opportunity that now these defendants are capitalizing upon to say that they could amend the bylaws with a mere majority vote and obviate the need for more than two-thirds vote to dispose of most of the assets of the corporation. Thank you.
Call the next case.